The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
This is an episode from the Lawfare Archive for December 30th, 2022. If you've been anywhere near the internet recently, chances are you've heard something about artificial intelligence. Whether it's the recent uproar over ChatGPT's ability to write news stories, or the Biden administration's recent AI bill. To put it all into context, the Lawfare team chose an episode from March 2021. In this episode, Alvaro Marañón sat down with Eric Larson to discuss the limitations of artificial intelligence, if there are any dangers associated with our current approach, and if AI's advancement to superintelligence really is inevitable.
I'm Alvaro Marañón, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 31st, 2021. I sat down recently with Eric Larson, a computer scientist, tech entrepreneur, and author of the new book, The Myth of Artificial Intelligence, Why Computers Can't Think the Way We Do. Eric and I spoke about his background and expertise with artificial intelligence, what shaped our modern perception of AI, and why the next big break in AI always appears to be 10 or 20 years away. We also discussed the current limitations of artificial intelligence, whether there are any dangers to our current approach, and if AI's advancements to superintelligence is really inevitable. It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 31st, The Myth of Artificial Intelligence. So before starting with the book, I wanted to ask a little bit about yourself and what path you took to writing this book and generally artificial intelligence.
Yeah, so I started in AI actually working as a practitioner in the field just over 20 years ago. Actually, I started in 2000, which sort of dates me, I guess. And I started out working on what we call ontology development. Sort of now we call that knowledge graph development, which is sort of inherited from the old way of doing AI. So you're building taxonomic structures to represent knowledge about the world or about a particular domain. And then I moved into sort of machine learning. So I was doing kind of like roll up your sleeves, doing a lot of AI, doing software development in the traditional sense as well. And in the sort of in the mid 2000s, this is when kind of big tech took off and there was this resurgence in discussion about artificial intelligence and what it could do. And I noticed that all these guys that were actually bona fide experts in the field, not all, but there was a certain percentage of them who are making these just completely wild claims about where we were headed and implying that it was sort of around the corner to get general intelligence and, you know, even kind of talking about machines sort of having consciousness and being, you know, having a kind of mental life at the far end of the development. And it just was a complete cognitive dissonance from anything that we were actually doing as practitioners in the field, scientists, as computer scientists. And so I just thought, you know, the public needs to know that this is by many of our lights, this is a very radical sort of speculative philosophical take on AI. And the many of us disagree with this. And it's sort of like that message needs to get out. And so that was sort of what prompted it early on. That started getting me thinking about the book. And then sort of as things kind of progressed in the last decade, I noticed that there was this kind of consolidation of the narrative by big tech, which bothered me as well. And so sort of like for the little guy, instead of saying that we're on this kind of determined path and it's all sort of being driven by these big data systems coming out of these large corporations, that actually we need innovation like we always do in society. And so it was a sort of call also to say, we don't have these problems solved. In fact, we're quite clueless about these at the far end, and we need people to join the field and think about them rather than proclaim victory. So it was kind of that. It was sort of pushback about that cultural narrative that we've been experiencing. And to some extent, by the way, that narrative of sort of imminent AGI or general intelligence has been kind of part and parcel of the field since its inception. It's not necessarily anything new, but it's certainly been kind of on steroids this in this last cycle of AI, which what I would put this last cycle of AI roughly at the turn of that, the turn of the century, where we had the sort of the advent of the web was when we saw a difference in attitude about artificial intelligence work. And there's a reason for that, but it's a longer discussion.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, thank you for that. And so maybe this is a little broad claim, but I think we should be a little safe from AI-run podcasts for a little while, correct?
Yeah. I mean, natural language in particular is a notoriously thorny problem for AI systems. So you can get kind of canned text generation and to some extent text comprehension from the systems we have, but you're not going to get James Joyce anytime soon.
Yeah. A little reassuring. So with this book, who should read it and what does it seek to answer? I know you gave us a little bit of background, but will identify the main issues with current cultural and technological myths in AI or go beyond that?
Yeah, I do that in the book. The book, I wrote the book for non-specialists in the field, but intending to provide sufficient technical development in the areas where it was needed so that the specialists wouldn't say, this is light on actual specifics or details, like sort of what is deep learning and sort of why do we have limitations we see in the current systems that we're deploying all over the place. And so I wrote it that so that it would kind of address also these larger philosophical claims. And so one thing I needed to do is explain sort of why it's so beguiling for us to think that we can kind of construct meaning or sort of find meaning, as it were, in society through technology, which is obviously a very big lens kind of question. So the myth of AI is actually like we tell stories that sort of highlight or illuminate aspects of our experience. And those stories can go back thousands of years. But in this case, we have a kind of modern myth that seems to be kind of like it's a sort of gravitron force in culture that's kind of sucking everyone towards it in spite of themselves. And so there's a significant section of the book that's just putting the AI question in context, historical context. But yeah, it's written for a general reader. It'll appeal to people who just wonder what's going on with AI, like, you know, sort of how do we make sense of fact and fiction? And also the specialist or the scientist will find lots of discussion in there that's suitable for them as well. I hope.
Yeah. No, yeah, I definitely enjoyed it. I also like the historical backgrounds, which you initially begin with philosophers and also the founder of modern AI and his infamous test. And I wanted to ask you, do you think, if we can start with the test, but also going further than that, do you think that's a proper way to frame intelligence? And if you could break down what intelligence means in this sense, like narrow applications versus general, for the listener who hasn't really followed AI and their developments.
Right. So you're referring to the Turing test, which we
yes,
mm-hmm. Turing never called it the Turing test, but we did because he originally posed it as a kind of core challenge for AI. So it actually predates. It's anachronism to say that Turing was talking about artificial intelligence, because the term itself was coined by the late John McCarthy, who had a very stellar career in AI at Stanford. And so the AI sort of came about in 1956 at this Dartmouth conference. But in 1950, Alan Turing, who gave us the mathematical treatment of what a computation itself is, he wrote a paper that's now just in the annals of history. I mean, it's just like nobody will ever forget this paper, because he introduces the imitation game, which in its original form was, you have a man and a woman and a judge who can't see the man or the woman, who are contestants in a conversational game, in effect. And the idea was that the man had to convince the judge that he was, in fact, the woman. And Turing sort of took that and made a slight twist on it and said, imagine if it was just a person, human person, and a computer system, and the answers were supplied in teletype, or what we would now say is text. And so the judge would just basically engage in a chat discussion with a person and a computer. And if the judge can't tell the difference between the two, and it's an open-ended sort of discussion, so any topic is suitable. The judge is free to ask anything. It's not factoids like Jeopardy. It's just conversation. And if at the end of I can't remember now actually if Turing put a time limit on it, but usually now there's something called the Loebner Prize, and it's 5 minutes of unrestricted conversation. Now, this is extremely difficult, and no system has really passed it to date, except for using just a variety of evasion tactics, which are just ridiculous. I mean, it's just silly, right? Because the whole point is to measure your understanding of stuff. So if you're just evading questions, you're not even taking the test, right? So that's a somewhat side note. But this, so the question of the Turing test was posed as a litmus test for intelligence in 1950 by the kind of mathematical pioneer of computational systems writ large. And I think it is a good touchstone, actually, as witnessed by the fact that Turing himself predicted his test would be passed by the turn of the century 2000. And certainly that didn't happen. And we still have an ongoing challenge to get, say, Alexa or Siri to really get what we're saying. So to put it in a practical context, the Turing test is nothing other than, why does Alexa not know what I'm talking about? Right? Like, why are these all canned responses? And so it's sort of easy to find such that this the flimsiest layer of understanding. It's really non-understanding. And so I think it's been borne out as a good test. Now, there are theoretical reasons why natural language is difficult for computational systems. There are actually reasons behind that. But just in terms of the development of the field, it's been a very difficult and it's still completely unsolved problem. So I think that answers like half of your question. The other half was something like, what is intelligence?
Yeah, it's kind of going back to the test, but let's say a system is created and tries to partake in this test, responding with sarcasm or misdirections would not pass it, correct? Like that isn't intelligence?
No, I mean, so the idea with the Turing test is precisely not to do that, to actually enter into the discussion in good faith. So it's curious. There are a number of one, the sort of the most high profile being maybe Stuart Russell at Berkeley right now, who argues that we should throw the test out because you can use these tricks to fool a judge. So for instance, the system in 2014 was named after a 13-year-old Ukrainian boy. It was developed by a team of Russian computer scientists. I think they may be Ukraine. I actually lived in Ukraine for a couple of years, so they really, the difference actually matters to them. but anyway, so when they took the Loebner Prize and the system used a variety of evasive techniques, tactics, and tricks it fooled something on the order of 30% of the judges over a few minutes into thinking it was human. And that prompted some researchers like Stuart Russell to say, we should throw the test out then, because that's just a chat bot. Like, it's just, right? Like, it's just ridiculous. It's just Python code that was trained on a bunch of data, like conversational discourse, and then just spits out stuff. And then when it can't find a high probability answer to return in response to a text, being presented with a text question, then it just spits out a kind of evasive, you know, joke. So we should get rid of the Turing test, but he just got it exactly backwards. You should just fix that. It's like very easy. So like in the book, I mentioned a couple situations that would completely eliminate this as a bar to assessment. One would be like, suppose you have to stand in front of a judge and like that's the social context within which the text is performed. Well, you just can't be sarcastic to a, you know, right? You have to answer to the best of your ability the questions, or you're going to be held in contempt. And so you could just import that framework into the test, and you couldn't have a 13-year-old dissembling Ukrainian boy who speaks broken English get over on this sort of world famous AI, you know, litmus test for AI. So I don't find Russell at all's suggestion that the test is fundamentally flawed to be particularly persuasive. I think it's easy to fix the test. What the hard part is actually to get the systems to know what you're talking about. So I think that's the angle that I want to go with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we see a lot of progress or advancements in specific intelligence or narrow intelligence. So we see IBM Watson trying to beat someone at Jeopardy, or now giving fantasy proposals in fantasy sports. And this kind of sparks a question, or just the myth you discuss of the inevitability phenomena. Eventually, humankind will just discover this issue of general intelligence. And you go in great depth to talk about this and the problems of this framing. And if you could expand upon that and its relationship with just general intelligence, or the problem of.
Right. So the question of narrow AI, which is usually put as a kind of pejorative, right? The inevitability thesis of AI is something like, if we just keep making progress on simpler problems, then we will eventually arrive at a kind of general intelligence that undergirds, you know, human thinking. So we have this curious ability to make sense of things in context, right? And we have this curious ability to navigate dynamic environments. So there are things that we do quite naturally with our human brains or minds that really flummox computational systems. But the thesis is that we're making steady progress. So all you have to do is extrapolate forward in time, and you can see that we'll eventually match these capabilities of the human mind and then surpass them. So my argument is that's actually unscientific, because what we're supposed to be doing is evaluating the evidence that we have on hand for the inevitability thesis in the first place. And my argument in the book and everywhere else is that the evidence suggests that we're not on a trajectory of inevitability, but in fact, we have some very large and sort of still unknown problem lurking ahead that we don't really understand how to solve. And so you might say that we're on a trajectory to continue to chisel away at narrow problems. So AI, in sort of in the scope of the discipline as a subfield of computer science, in the last 70 years or however long it's been, has been very good at taking teams or individual scientists, identifying problems that we can model and represent, and then finding solutions to those problems. Jeopardy, you mentioned, is a very good one. The IBM guys under Dave Ferrucci did a fantastic job of really deconstructing the game of Jeopardy and making it computationally feasible, right? So I actually did a deep dive into studying that system, and it's a very impressive system, but it is not an evidence proof for the inevitability thesis. It's actually another example of narrow AI. So I would say that we have this trajectory of, you know, as a function of time, like scientists keep identifying problems that can be solved, but they all have a curious quality to them. They're all in some sense artificial compared to the dynamic real world environment that we operate in nature. So gameplay is just a case in point. Go was the last game to fall to computation. The system was AlphaZero, which itself was a sort of evolved system from AlphaGo. Both were developed out of Google Labs. I think their subsidiary is DeepMind, actually, but they purchased it. It's all sort of part of the Google umbrella now. And Go is, I've never played Go, but my understanding is that's an extraordinarily cognitively challenging game for humans. But it turns out that just by analyzing millions of prior moves, you can just use essentially high capacity statistics to say, okay, these moves are all highest probability for being successful moves. And so the computer actually can just sort of, you know, in Casio calculator fashion, I mean, it's a little more complicated than that, but actually just by analysis of prior gameplay can actually play the game. It doesn't have to understand the game and it doesn't have to cogitate about what to do. It's actually just plucking from options that were given to it by prior gameplay. If you remove the millions of prior games that were digitized and supplied to the computer, if you remove that element and require original thinking, it just doesn't have anything to say. It doesn't understand it's playing the game, for one, and it doesn't have any ability to sort of play it in an insightful way. So I don't think these are not examples of the inevitability thesis. They're actually support for the somewhat more sobering thesis that computer science seems to be good at deconstructing certain types of narrow problems and then inserting computational solutions for them. That has nothing to do with the mythology of AI about general intelligence. It's complete apples and oranges.
Great. And that's very illustrative of the problems that you describe with games, especially the closed world, like fixed rules. So chess was one of the big pioneers in this field, where you have like predetermined rules and sets, and you can kind of calculate your way out based on the inputs and outputs. And a concept you kept describing was supervised learning and unsupervised, and there's a middle ground. And I just want to have your explanation on this and how this plays a role into artificial intelligence going forward. Can we have a system that has supervised inputs and outputs eventually just break through? Or like you said again, is that an inevitability problem arising?
Yeah, so supervised learning is the most powerful and popular type of learning. And learning itself is essentially exposing a computer algorithm to examples. So you have positive examples of something that you want the computer to learn. And those examples are generally tagged or otherwise indicated by the designers. And so by seeing many, many thousands and sometimes millions positive examples and negative examples, the computer can build what's called a model of that problem, which is basically a set of, simplified, just to put it this way, it's a sort of huge decision tree with probabilities attached to it. So it says, when I'm here and I have choice A or choice B, if choice A is a higher probability, then I go to A, and so on. So that's called a model of that problem. And in the supervised case, the human engineer or developer of the system will actually specify what are good examples, right? And supervised learning is powerful because you've actually got a human signal in the loop. So my area of specialty is natural language processing. And in this case, just to take a very simple example, we can use a spam filter. So in a spam filter, you have a binary decision. It's either spam or it's not, right? That's how that works. And if you, as you receive, let's say you're training a supervised model in the background, and you are actually, by the way, when you're saying, mark this as spam. You actually are training a supervised model.
Reinforcement. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's exactly how it works. So when you say that something is spam, you're actually supervising the algorithm that's running in the background. So it sees that as a positive example of spam. And anything that's not marked as spam by default is just is not spam, right? So it just needs to make that binary choice. So yeah, so in a spam problem, which is actually is a subset of a problem called text classification, where you put a label on an entire text or discourse. In news, you might say sports, politics, and so on, right? Like this is the article, this is the topic. You train the model by actually supplying spam or not spam. And if you went to an unsupervised case, you'd have to use something like a clustering approach or a different approach to try to group all the spam without a human supplied tag or label or signal, right? To somehow group the data such that the spam ended up in one cluster and the non-spam in another. And typically those sorts of approaches are a lot less reliable and a lot less useful. Now with supervised learning, you have to put in a lot of elbow grease, right? So the spam is actually a really nice demonstration of supervised learning in action, because you will sort of in your day-to-day world just say, okay, this is spam. I don't want, you know, an advertisement for whatever it is, you know, umbrellas or whatever, to put that in there. And so you're doing that sort of naturally, and you don't notice that you're actually supplying intelligence to the system and you're doing work. In other problems, it's very obvious that there's somebody sitting there. And for instance, if you're doing computational linguistics, then you have to mark all the examples of metaphor or the examples of verb phrases or auxiliary verbs or something, or whatever it is that you're doing. You've got to actually have a linguist or a linguistics student maybe sit there and read stuff and go through this laborious process. Now, the question is that kind of powerful learning, the supervised case of learning, is that promising for a kind of expanding into general intelligence? And the answer is no, because again, you have to put boundaries on the problem in order to get a good, what's called a well-defined problem, right? So if you're trying to get the computer to learn spam, then you've got to, in some sense, narrow the problem to the spam world, and everything becomes a question of spam or not spam. You can't turn it around and say, and by the way, love letters or, you know, news from Australia. I mean, it's just like, you're always kind of defining a problem so it's specific in the engineering sense, so that the learning problem is well defined. And so in that sense, it's another example of narrow. It's a perfect example, actually, of narrow but powerful learning. And by powerful, I mean you can achieve some impressive results given that you have a well-defined problem. So, but it doesn't bear on the question of general intelligence. There's no bridge theoretically, and that gets into the inference framework, which is of course the core. It's a core part of the book. But so in a sense, the learning. I'll just throw this in to kind of throw more fuel on the fire here of this terribly negative
yes.
take on AI, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although, you know, here I am, like I'm building a system right now to improve movie recommendations, and I'm using all these techniques. So they're incredibly useful. And when you have got a good problem and you have a, you know, an angle maybe so you can improve on prior performance, it's really exciting to do this stuff. That's a separate discussion from the general intelligence inevitability question.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, Lawfare listeners, Ben Wittes here. Want to tell you about the first time I got a report from the folks at Delete Me. It was shortly after I started using the service back in 2022, and they sent me their first privacy report. I have since gotten 8 others, and it contained some shocking information. They had removed my data from 56 separate data brokers, that this had included 133 separate records, including 621 individual pieces of personal information. The data broker with the most information about me was a company I'd never heard of called People by Name. And here's the thing. Since then, every couple of months, I've gotten another privacy report from Delete Me, and it always contains more information that they have removed from the data brokers about me. In the second report, they informed me they had removed my stuff from 41 data brokers and that the one with the most information about me was called Hleck. I have no idea what Hleck is. So the other day, I got my latest report and it includes 15 more data brokers with my personal information, 113 pieces of personally identifiable information. Big culprit this time is something called My Life. Well, I want to tell you that they don't have My Life anymore. And that is why I recommend Delete Me. As this little anecdote shows, there's a lot of my data out there. And these companies keep acquiring it and making it available to anybody who can pay. And I have slept a little bit more easily ever since I found a solution to this problem. And I want to stress, as I do every time, that I started using this before Delete Me started advertising with Lawfare. Delete Me finds and removes any personal information you don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. And that's the point of this little story, that, you know, they keep coming back. You can get it removed once, but they'll put it back. And then Delete Me comes and takes it off again. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from the largest people search databases on the web, and in the process helps prevent potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. Delete Me sends you regular personalized privacy reports, just like the ones I've been describing, showing what info they found where they found it, and what they removed. And critically, as this story reflects, it isn't just a one-time service. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. It does all the hard work of wiping you and your family's personal information off the web. Data brokers hate Delete Me, which is why I like it. Your profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for our listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use promo code lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code LAWFARE20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/LAWFARE20, code LAWFARE20.
So going back to the narrowness application, so a lot of the contemporary things we see and the progress we see is whether it's facial recognition, which is pattern recognition or identification, but also through social media. So like you previously explained, the reinforcement aspect, that's a major role in what we see through content, correct? Through social media platforms?
Yeah, that's right.
And facial recognition. So you, in your book, you identified one of the famous or infamous examples of a company incorrectly identifying an individual with an image of an animal.
That's right.
And you spoke about how they removed a certain data set of the animal and consider that sort of like a win. We addressed the issue. Could you expand upon that and see how that's kind of reflective of bigger societal myths with artificial intelligence?
Right. So, I mean, that's a particularly thorny example, but in that particular example, the Google system, this is all on the web. So I'm just restating. So the Google system, there was an African-American couple or friends or something in a photo, and Google labeled that photo as an example of a gorilla. And so, of course, people erupted about this, and you know, it was just a complete PR disaster for Google. They're not going to fall back on some technical explanation, because in this sense, like, it just really doesn't matter what's going on. Like, we can't have the AI system isn't sort of protected from the results of, and if we get into self-driving cars, this is going to be really even more apparent because you have safety issues. But in this case, you have these social results that, you know, Google executives are going to fall back on and say, well, it's just an algorithm and there's some, you know, rate of error and so on. So like, that's not acceptable. So it's an example also, by the way, of these algorithms increasingly being pushed into areas of culture, right? So on the web, there's an almost ubiquitous use of machine learning approaches that do image classification, for instance, on Facebook. So you have like pictures, it identifies behind the scenes, oh, these are pictures tagging of friends. Auto tagging and so on. And so, and also with respect to some degree, although there's still humans in the loop when you try to find inappropriate tweets and so on, there are systems, but they don't work. They can't be part of the problem is it's really difficult to figure out when somebody is using, say, hate speech. It's really difficult to figure out intent, and you certainly can't offload that to an algorithm who's only looking at the text token in without context, right? So having no knowledge of sort of human intentions and purposes and contextual issues, it could be just complete sarcasm and innocuous, or it could be, you know, something like really nefarious. And the system's certainly not going to make those kind of decisions. So, but you get the system kind of, these systems are pushed into service constantly. And so in image classification, you can have these really terrible, insensitive results from the system. And the system just doesn't know what it's doing, right? We don't know what it was focusing on or how it made that decision. The deep learning, which is a kind of neural network, which is a kind of machine learning, which is what we've been talking about, are notoriously opaque in the sense that you can't sort of deconstruct them after the fact and say, you know, why did you misclassify these photos? We just don't know. We don't know what it was relying on in the pixelated data, because it goes through so many obfuscating layers, right? Basically to optimize. And there's another, by the way, there's another great example with Microsoft, who launched a chatbot called Tay.
Oh man.
Using like F words and just saying it was just
Murphy's Law equivalent, I guess, for speech.
Yeah, that got yanked within 24 hours. But in this case, the PR disaster for Google, they couldn't fix the system and they couldn't have those results flowing into their user base clearly. And so they just pulled any classification of gorillas. So there's some Jane Goodall lurking out there that's just, you know, shaking her fist at Google, right? Because, you know, like there's all these sort of applications for people who want images of natural of animals, mm-hmm. I would assume, and so on. But there's just no way to sort of figure out, you know, in real time or any kind of time that, you know, that's proper. Is there's no way to figure out like sort of how do we fix these systems, because they're just distributed massive data systems. So they yank the ability for that to classify that. And, you know, part of that is just driven by understandable reaction. And part of it's also driven by the fact that, you know, we don't really, you know, have as much of a clue as how we're getting the results for these systems as we'd like. So it's not the, I don't think it's really the best example of short term. I would put the entire use of inductive or machine learning approaches as the kind of bleeding edge or tip of the spear for AI progress, I would put that entire, the decision to use that stuff is entirely more economically driven than it is showing a real bona fide concern for getting to general AGI, getting to general intelligence. Because we just know that there are these inherent limitations to data-driven or inductive systems that can't be overcome with more data. And so we just know we're not going to get to general intelligence if we keep doing what we're doing. And so, yeah, I mean, that's what I would say. And then just as a quick sort of aside here, the question with self-driving cars has really been, you've noticed, I mean, circa sort of 2016, 2017, it seemed like self-driving cars were around the corner, right? And now, we're about 5 years. I put the kind of peak excitement at that at some time between 2015, 2020. And now we're in 2021 and you sort of don't hear about them anymore. Now, obviously, we just went through a huge disruption with the pandemic, fears of COVID and so on. And that kind of disrupted the AI narrative, as you would expect. But even given that, even allowing for that, there is a kind of cold water feel to the self-driving cars possibility. And that's also driven by technical challenges. We've had a number of really high profile cases where the cars killed people and they can't, just as the case with the gorilla images, they can't sort of do the postmortem and figure out how to fix the problem. Because in some very real sense, the problem is central and endemic to the approach itself. So, like if you pixelate a school bus, it might look like an overpass. And that's kind of bad if you think you can drive under a school bus.
Understatement.
Yeah. So that's another example of a situation where, in the Google case, you're going to pull out of the data set the offending images so that the problem can't recur and, sort of problem solved in that narrow sense. But in the self-driving cars case, you can't sort of, if you can't fix a safety issue on the road, you can't deploy the technology at all, right? So we do have, I mean, the technology is coming into car, like the machine learning stuff we're talking about actually is in modern cars. So if you're doing autonomous driving at all, or semi-autonomous driving, I should say, at all, then you have systems that are actually tracking, doing visual object recognition and so on the roads.
And yeah, it kind of illustrates again the problem of the unknown, also just the hindsight bias that humans have with these systems. You got to create like a fixed set of rules or a set of notions, and it's kind of hard to account for the human element of like rule breaking. Let's say like a jaywalker or someone running across the street. These are things that are outside the scope of traditional rules.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you can look at this most clearly, I think, if you look at the aviation case. So we have systems that can land 737s without human involvement now. But if you look at sort of what's involved with taking a jet from cruising altitude to runway, you have a geometrical descending line that's controlled by thrust and ailerons and so on. And there's nothing, there's nobody that's going to run out in front of the jet, right? Like it's sort of maybe a little counterintuitive because you think of that as being an extremely difficult problem. I certainly wouldn't want to be the one trying to do it without, you have to be trained and so on. It just seems like it's way harder than driving a car, but not for an AI system, because what really defeats the AI system are those contingencies that you mentioned, right? Like the jaywalker or the ducks, walking across the road, or the, snow is notoriously difficult, or bad road conditions can be bad because, this pothole, what is that? Do I slam on the brakes for a minor pothole? Or just like all these decisions that happen in the course of driving, where you have a much more dynamic and changing environment in front of those sensors than you do on an aircraft. So you have you really do have solid AI that's able to work in the aviation case. And in the driving case, we have endless. It seems like now to get to what's called level 5, which is fully automated navigation with no driver in the loop, it seems like that's going to be an actually long haul problem now for AI. Like, we're not going to see that anytime soon. And you certainly wouldn't have heard that in 2016, but it's just this discovery of the difference between narrow and general intelligence, right?
And this also, I guess, brings back the problem of inference that you speak in depth about. And I wonder if you could expand upon it now, just the problem of inference, deduction, induction, and abduction.
Yeah. So just as a little bit of background, one of my frustrations when I was thinking about writing the book was that a lot of the air just kind of gets sucked up with this question of whether computers can be conscious, right? Like whether they can have an inner life, whether they sort of can ever...
Westworld type of...
Yeah, like were they ever become aware of the fact that they're thinking, or... Right? And then there is this interesting question about whether when we're thinking, whether we can sort of do thinking without being minds. I don't mean it necessarily in the Cartesian sense of like having this, you know, floating thing, but just having our brains put together a kind of gestalt picture that also includes in what it's like to be that gestalt picture, right? What it's like to be somebody perceiving and thinking in the world. It's unclear how much you can separate our cognizing from that, the questions of consciousness. But I didn't like this question when it comes to AI, because it's such a downstream problem that it kind of distracts us from looking at things that are right in front of our face with respect to challenges in the field. So I shifted away from consciousness to what's called inference. And it's just, inference is kind of this notoriously polysemous or many-meaning word in the English language. But for the purposes of the discussion, it means if given what you already know, the stuff that you already know, and what you can see or observe, what's plausible or meaningful, or what's the next thing that you should believe, right? So inference is just always a kind of move from knowledge and observation to new knowledge, basically, or to belief, which is like, knowledge that you think is true, but may or may not be. And so we know a lot about inference, actually, because one of the first things that out of the Greek, the ancient world, one of the first questions that were fascinating to Aristotle, and really before Aristotle, was this, like, how do we know when somebody's making an argument that it's a good argument? Like, mm-hmm. And I give an example in the book of God is love, God is blind, Ray Charles is blind, therefore Ray Charles is God, or something like that. Like, yeah, there's all these ways that we can actually seem as if we're sort of making a conclusion or drawing an inference, and in fact, we're talking nonsense. So, but we know a lot about inference, and deduction was one of the first explored types of inference, going all the way back to the syllogism, which is just two premises and a conclusion. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal, is the classic example. And then induction, we know a lot about that because sort of beginning, this is really a simplified view of intellectual history, but beginning with Bacon and some of the progenitors to the scientific turn in the 16th century, Bacon started saying, and others were saying, look, we need to get knowledge. We can't sort of be relying on these Platonic reasoning forms or Aristotelian reasoning forms. We actually need to just be observing the world and drawing conclusions. And that turns out to be induction. And induction has been formalized and studied for centuries, and in large part does undergird our scientific investigations, in the sense that you can't understand what, say, DNA is unless you look at DNA molecules, right? Like, you have to actually observe the world. You can't conclude a lot of things from first principles. So the classic distinction is, like, you can know that a triangle has three sides without looking at triangular objects in the world. In fact, you might want to abstract away from observation in the physical world if you want to do geometrical or Euclidean geometry, right? Like, you want to just look at ideal cases. And you can know everything about a triangle without observing one in the world, right? And that's deduction. But if you want to know about how things work in the flow of time, then you've got to actually look at how things change. And that's induction. And the classic sort of paradigm case of induction is that the conclusion that all swans are white, because in England anyway, all swans are white. And of course, the great 20th century British philosopher Bertrand Russell used the swans are white induction. So I see 10,000 white swans, and I conclude that all swans are white. So there's the inductive inference from this large sample to the sum total of swans. So it becomes an actual property of swans that they have white feathers, right? That's the inductive generalization, as opposed to selecting from a very large set of swans that all have white. So you actually do make this inference. But Russell said famously that it turns out actually that he used this as an example of how induction is actually limited, because there are black swans in Australia, and you don't know by purely induction unless you go to Australia and observe them, right? So you can't, in pure induction, you have to
have like perfect information or perfect observation.
Yeah, you can't bring in causal information about habitat affecting color and so on, and here's two different habitats. That's not induction, that's something else. Induction, pure and simple, is just observation-based inference. So, and it turns out that machine learning is induction. That's exactly what it is, actually. It's just a picture perfect case of computational induction. And it turns out that the older AI, sort of circa before the year 2000, before the advent of the web, when we had all this data to work with, is all deduction or variance of it. And there you can look at it for programmers, any programmer listeners, if you have conditional rules, that is a species of deduction. It's a little more complicated than that, because you have to actually quantify the variables to get deduction. But for purposes of this, if you write physically rules in the system, conditionals, if then conditionals, you're using some variant, some simplified variant of deduction. So you can sort of break AI up into the pre-modern era of relying on rule-based or deductive techniques, into our current modern era of using primarily induction. And it turns out that neither induction or deduction, knowably, we know this visibly, is adequate for reproducing general intelligence. And so there's a third type that's not very well known outside of sort of mathematical logic, but it's called abduction. It's kind of an unfortunate name for it. But the philosopher scientist Charles Sanders Peirce first gave a lengthy development of abduction as a third variant of inference that largely accounts for what we're doing day to day. And it's really unfortunate that Peirce's writings, which sat in Harvard's library till I think 40 years yes. after his death. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I go through in the book and I explain, you know, it's very unfortunate, because to some extent, even still today, there's not a really a flow of knowledge in computer science proper in the field between sort of what Peirce was talking about and kind of how that can illuminate problems that we're having in the field. Like, you don't really have that. I mean, there are, so the Allen Institute in Seattle, for instance, with Oren Etzioni, who's a former University of Washington professor. He's also an entrepreneur. He was the guy behind Faircast, which is one of the early flight, like a Travelocity type site, where he was doing real-time prediction of prices. He made a bunch of money. He was one of the first guys to realize the value of big data, actually. Like, it does have commercial value. Even if it can't get us to general intelligence, you can. And so Etzioni is a really smart guy. I have a lot of respect for him. And he runs the AI lab in Seattle called the Allen Institute after Paul Allen, the late Paul Allen, who was, of course, the co-founder of Microsoft. And Paul Allen started that institute to explore general intelligence. And Etzioni, the reason I bring him up is that they are actually trying to implement versions of abduction using what's called Bayes' nets. But they're extremely simplified. I call them abduction in name only. And there's a reason for that. It's not because they lack imagination. It's because nobody really knows how to do abduction.
It's like the next frontier, essentially.
Yeah. And it's actually unclear whether, and this is the sort of the most skeptical thing I'm going to say, is that to me anyway, it's actually profoundly unclear whether it has a computational treatment at all. And given that we know that it undergirds almost all of the thinking that we do as human beings, it does raise this question as to whether we're ever really going to capture general intelligence in computer systems. Yeah, but that's the inference framework. You have three types. They can't be reduced to each other. So it's provably that you can't make abduction a species of induction or deduction, right? So it can't be reduced and conquered that way. So they're distinct, and they're non-overlapping and distinct. So once we realize that deduction and induction doesn't account for general intelligence and abduction does, and we have nothing on offer for abduction, and in fact you can divide the entire history of the field of AI between induction and deduction, we know we have a big problem. We're not even on the right path, is the point. We don't know how to get out of induction mode, right, that we're in today. We know that we can't just analyze large data sets with statistics. The philosophers actually told us this. This is one area where philosophers weren't wasting our time. And like it's like really a valid critique of this kind of thinking, but we just don't know how to get out of that because we don't have anything on offer. There's no, like, if you held a gun to my head and said, you know, design an abductive reasoning engine, in Python or code or, you know, or something, I just wouldn't know what to write. I just wouldn't know what to put down on the, you know. So there's we have a problem in AI that we shouldn't skirt. And that gets at the rub there.
Okay. Thank you for that. Maybe a closing remark or a little bit forward thinking. The current approach we have, you've highlighted some of the dangers. And I just wanted to ask if one day let's say the next 5-10 years, you're put in the position to lead AI in the United States, what are some things you would like to see happen or type of ideological shifts in how we approach AI? And also, what are some dangers that you've identified with the current approach and why it's not sustainable?
Yeah. So is this kind of like if I ruled the world, the AI world, what would I do?
Exactly.
Yeah. So I have a kind of seemingly hand waving response to that, but I think sort of at second glance, there's a lot of merit in it, which is, you know, it was Norbert Wiener, the guy who coined the term cybernetics in the 1940s, who first made the point that a culture is unlikely to hit upon new ideas unless new ideas are valued. And so one of the things that we can do in the field of AI is stop chasing after shiny solutions that we, you know, given a little more reflection, know aren't going to get us to the finish line. It's just, the field, of course, is driven. There's all the usual incentives for AI researchers to use techniques that work on commercially viable applications. And so it's certainly understandable that we're using big data when we, you know, we're spending most of our lives online and all we're doing is generate a giant text that's basically supplied as input to inductive algorithms. So it's certainly understandable that we have a short-term gain in these commercial systems from Facebook and Twitter and so on, and for movie recommendations on Netflix and for
beating Go, whatnot.
Yeah, right. And so, but one of the problems is that we're not actually investing as Wiener said, even before AI was really even a thing, we're not really investing in a culture of ideas when we do this. And I think you can see a connection between what I see as a kind of shallowing out, sort of gutting out of the intellectual content of the culture. I mean, we're very concerned about this. Some of the things that I'm thinking about now are just not even AI questions, although they're related to our, you know, our fascination with technology. But to make progress in AI, the first thing you've got to do is admit what the current limitations are, and then you've got to invest in independent research. And so you need research that's not tied to short-term commercial objectives. And so we can't just have Google. Either Google has to have a kind of culture of innovation where they recognize that the dollars that they're flowing to scientists might not have immediate payouts, and they don't necessarily have to be married to commercial objectives within the company. Google has to see the wisdom of that, or the DoD through DARPA, although they're, of course, defense-oriented, but there's nothing wrong with that. But my last two companies were DARPA-funded, and you just always end up working on some, you know, like it's always some defense-related thing, of course, like what you're doing, even with DARPA. But DARPA, to their credit, will invest in big-picture ideas. But we need more of that. So that's a maybe that seems like a weaselly answer, like you don't have the blueprint. The point is that we need the smartest people working on problems that are not restrained or constricted to short-term commercial gain. So that would be my big picture answer. And in general, we need the culture, I think, to realize that we're stagnating, in my view. And not only do I think AI has hit a flat point in its trajectory of progress, and we need new ideas in AI, but I think that our marriage to AI systems, for convenience and otherwise, has kind of by degrees pulled us away from this idea that it's incumbent upon every generation to do original thinking. So that's part of the fix of the AI. As to how we get sort of to general intelligence, you know, I really don't have an idea. The best that we can do now is build hybrid systems that incorporate deductive and inductive approaches in novel ways. And you get the intelligence kind of as a overarching, you know, an effect from the operation of the whole system. And so actually Watson was an example of a really, really smart hybrid system, you know, that didn't use just one approach, but combined them to solve a difficult problem in a novel way. And so we need people to realize that just because you have a hammer, you know, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I think that's kind of deep learning or machine learning right now. And it turns out that, yeah, that actually a lot of these problems aren't nails, right? And so hybrid systems is one way to be more flexible in our thinking about design and development of AI. And also just that, like, we need to kind of, I think, this is my personal kind of, you know, hobby horse here, but I think we need to sort of reinvest in the culture of ideas. And that will help prevent AI from flatlining or going into one of its notorious winners, which I think we're right on the cusp of right now, actually.
This is like illustrative. You need to incentivize more Einsteins and more theoretical work than something measurable or like an end product, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you look at the periods of profound change and progress in, you know, at least in the Western world where we're more familiar, you see that the culture itself had an appreciation for the pursuit of, I mean, this sounds corny, but it's just, I don't know how else to put this. Like, it was just like the pursuit of big ideas, right? Mm-hmm. The embracing of big ideas. And so when Einstein, for instance, at the turn of the century was thinking about black body radiation, there were these really interesting unsolved problems in physics, and the brightest minds were getting together with chalk, you know, on the chalkboard. And it was in that kind of milieu that Einstein had his insight into special relativity. And, you know, I can't help but to wonder if you had a, you know, 16-year-old kid from Germany, you know, hanging out on Facebook today, whether this we even have a culture that would encourage this kind of just radical reconceptualization of these frameworks, right? We seem to be working out in the kind of almost mechanistic fashion the consequences of existing theory and existing ideas. And if you look at intellectual history, every time we've done that, we've ended up in war, conflict. You know, I mean, in the 20th century, we were in war within 40 years of relativity was 1905. So, you know, that can happen. We ended up in World War I in 1917. So that maybe war isn't the best example. How about stagnation?
A multitude of issues. Yeah, or
problems. A multitude of problems in culture, because it's like sort of every generation has to kind of learn what we already think we know, and then try to sort of push that in novel and unique directions. And one of the sort of tragedies of really well-functioning short-term technology is I think it creates this kind of world of mirrors, the situation where it seems as if every problem is on the verge of being solved and everybody's already figured out what to, you know, how to think and what to do. And that kind of conformity is bad. We certainly didn't see that in the Renaissance, where we had an explosion of not only a return to looking at the great literature and art and so on in the Greek and the classical times, but we also had an explosion of new ideas that led us out of the Dark Ages, right? And so it's in this time where you have this like unbounded possibility that we get the best out of ourselves. And culture just doesn't do that on its own. If you leave it to kind of work, you know, itself out in a trajectory, and especially when we have, you know, when we have a huge technology base, right? So there's just a ton of distractions and reasons not to do original thinking. And you can be forgiven for saying, well, how are you supposed to take on Google? And I mean, right? Like there's this sense in which, like, if you're growing up today and you're thinking, I'm going to make the next search engine, you can be sort of forgiven for saying that's a solved problem, but it's not actually. It's not a solved problem. That's not the end of the road with even search, which is just one piece of the bigger innovative puzzle. So yeah, I think like in the field of AI, we need more of that kind of recognition of limitations and the need for original thinking. And in culture in general, we need to get a little distance from our technology. And I was hoping that my book could kind of like put a wedge in there somehow and say, look, if we can be a little more skeptical and discerning about AI, maybe we can kind of be a little more appreciative of the unique contributions that human beings make in every era to bring about our own future.
Perfect. Thank you, Eric. And thank you for being on the show.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a 5-star review on iTunes. Go to thelawfarestore.com for brand new Lawfare pens, lanyards, t-shirts, and socks. The podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.